Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Okay, let's unpack this. Fyodor Dostoevsky's final novel, The Brothers Karamazov. When you step into this book, you're not just reading a story. It feels more like entering this huge, intense battlefield of ideas and, well, spirituality.
It really is. I mean, it's such a monumental work. You had people like Freud calling it the most magnificent novel ever written. That's quite something.
It is. And you can feel the weight of Dostoevsky's own life in it, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. His experiences, that mock execution, Siberia, it wasn't just background noise. It fundamentally shaped how he wrote, pushing him towards this deep psychological realism. He wasn't as interested in, say, social manners as he was in the chaos inside the human mind.
Right. It's less about the external world and much more about the internal landscapes, the conscience, the soul.
Exactly. His novels become these arenas where philosophies clash. He gives every major idea of his time a voice, a character who truly lives and breathes that perspective.
Which creates this incredible, almost overwhelming chorus of conflicting beliefs. It never feels settled.
And that's really why we wanted to do this deep dive. We want to offer you, the listener, a kind of guide through this vast territory. Show how the murder mystery at the center, while gripping, is really Dostoevsky's way of tackling these enormous philosophical questions.
So the setting is this provincial Russian town, Skoto-Prigonyevsk, in the 19th century. And it all revolves around one family, the Karamazovs. Utterly dysfunctional. The immediate plot driver is, you know, who killed the father, Fyodor Pavlovich. He's a truly awful figure.
He is. But the deeper question, the one that echoes throughout the entire novel, is the one Ivan poses. If God does not exist and there's no immortality, does that mean everything is permitted?
That question hangs over everything.
It really does. And the source of so much of the drama, the poison in the well, is Fyodor Pavlovich himself, the patriarch. He's not just a bad father. He's described as vulgar, lecherous, a buffoon. He seems to represent this force of moral decay. He almost enjoys degrading people.
Yeah, he's less a character with an arc and more like
yeah,
a catalyst,
yeah.
A necessary darkness that forces everyone else to react, to choose who they are.
He's the trauma at the heart of the family. And his three legitimate sons, they embody such different ways of dealing with him, with life itself.
Mm. You have Dmitry or Mitya, the eldest.
Right. Mitya is pure passion, isn't he? A sensualist caught between these extremes of high spiritual feeling and base behavior. So volatile, reckless, but with his own strange code of honor.
Then there's Ivan. Completely different, the intellectual. Mm. Cool, detached, rational. He tries to analyze the world, maybe even dismantle it purely through logic.
A brilliant mind, but deeply troubled by what that mind reveals.
And finally, Alexei or Alyosha. He's presented as the hero, isn't he? The gentle younger brother, a novice monk. He embodies this idea of compassion, seeking what Dostoevsky calls active love.
Yes, active love, which we'll definitely get into. But there's also the fourth son lurking in the shadows, Smerdyakov.
Ah, yes. The illegitimate son, working as a servant in Fyodor's house. He's filled with resentment, cynicism.
He's pure nihilism, really. And he listens very closely to Ivan's intellectual arguments. He's like the practical application of Ivan's theory waiting to happen.
The whole thing kicks off with this incredibly awkward, disastrous family meeting at the local monastery.
Right. On the surface, it's about settling Dmitry's inheritance claims against his father.
But it's really just a stage for all their hatred and rivalry to explode. Especially the rivalry over Grushenka, this captivating local woman both Fyodor and Dmitry are obsessed with.
Oh, it's a masterclass in tension and bad behavior.
Right.
You immediately see the deep ideological splits, the sheer animosity. It goes way beyond just money or Grushenka.
And Dmitry is just frantic at this point, desperate.
He needs money, specifically 3,000 rubles. He owes it to his fiancée, the proud Katerina Ivanovna, so he can break it off with her and, he hopes, run away with Grushenka.
This desperation fuels his recklessness. He's openly threatening his father, saying he might kill him.
And crucially, there's this incident where he attacks the old servant, Grigory, in a fit of rage, beats him quite badly.
That specific act becomes vital later on. It's used as key evidence against him. You could just feel the violence simmering, can't you? It feels inevitable.
Definitely. So we have this tangled family mess, this impending sense of doom. How does Dostoevsky elevate this from, you know, just a family drama to the philosophical core with Ivan?
Well, that's where the novel really takes flight, I think. The murder plot becomes the framework, but the real energy shifts towards Ivan and his profound intellectual rebellion. He fundamentally rejects God's creation. Why? because of suffering, particularly the suffering of innocent children. He just cannot accept a world where that happens.
It's not just doubt, it's a moral refusal. He famously collects these awful stories of child abuse and says he can't accept a divine harmony that's built on the torture of even one small child. It's that powerful line where he says he respectfully returns his ticket to God's world. He'd rather stay with his unanswerable questions than accept a system that seems so cruel.
And this rejection finds its most powerful expression in that famous story within a story, The Grand Inquisitor.
Ah, yes. An incredible piece of writing.
Aethon tells Alyosha this parable. Christ returns to earth during the Spanish Inquisition and is arrested by the Grand Inquisitor.
And the Inquisitor basically tells Christ he made a mistake, giving humanity free will. It was too much for them, an unbearable burden.
Exactly. The Inquisitor argues people don't want freedom. They crave security, certainty, someone to tell them what to do. They want miracle, mystery, and authority.
So the church, according to the Inquisitor, has corrected Christ's work by taking away that freedom, offering happiness and bread in exchange for obedience. It's terrifyingly persuasive.
It really is. It's a critique of any system, religious or political, that promises security at the cost of individual liberty. And this intellectual framework is what Smerdyakov picks up on.
If there's no God, no inherent morality, as Ivan seems to argue, then everything is permitted. Smerdyakov takes that not as a philosophical point, but as practical permission.
But Dostoevsky doesn't just leave Ivan's cold logic unchallenged, does he?
No, definitely not. The direct counterweight is Elder Zosima, Alyosha's spiritual mentor at the monastery. His teachings are the heart of the novel's alternative vision.
Zosima represents faith, but not a simplistic faith. It's grounded in this idea of active love.
Right. He teaches that real love isn't some dreamy sentiment. It's hard work. It's practical. As Zosima says, it's a harsh and dreadful thing compared to love and dreams. It means choosing to love the actual flawed people around you day by day.
And perhaps his most important teaching, directly challenging Ivan's isolation, is the idea of universal responsibility.
Yes, the idea that everyone is responsible for everyone and for everything. If you truly believe that, you can't detach yourself intellectually. You're implicated in all the suffering, and the only response is compassionate action.
It's the spiritual answer to Ivan's logical deadlock.
Absolutely, and this tension, this philosophical war, comes to a head on the night Fyodor is murdered.
Let's talk about that night. It's chaos.
Total chaos. And Dmitri walks right into the frame. He's frantic, goes to Fyodor's house thinking Grushenka is there, carrying a brass pestle. He peers in the window, sees Fyodor, but Grushenka isn't there. He decides not to go through with whatever he intended, and he flees.
But as he escapes over the garden wall, he strikes the servant Grigori, who tries to stop him, knocks him down, sees the blood.
Thinks he's killed him. Then he rushes off, finds Grushenka, and they start this wild, drunken party just as the police arrive to arrest him for his father's murder.
The evidence against Mitya looks overwhelming, doesn't it?
Completely. His public threats, his desperation for money, the fact he was there, the blood on his clothes, Grigori's testimony once he recovers. And crucially, he suddenly seems to have a lot of money, that missing 3,000 rubles.
So the legal system, looking at the facts rationally, points straight at Dmitri.
Yep. But we, the readers, know the truth. It was Smerdyakov.
He'd been listening to Ivan, absorbing that everything is permitted idea. He saw his chance, killed Fyodor, took the money, and used a feigned epileptic fit as his alibi. Brilliantly manipulative.
And he makes sure Dmitri is framed perfectly.
This is where Ivan's tragedy really unfolds, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. His abstract theories, things he probably never thought would actually happen, are made real by Smerdyakov.
Smerdyakov eventually confesses to Ivan, telling him he was just the instrument of Ivan's will, that Ivan was the real murderer because his philosophy allowed it.
He essentially says, "You taught me there was no sin, so I acted." And that responsibility just shatters Ivan's intellect.
We see this devastating psychological collapse, the hallucination of the devil.
Yeah, and not some grand Satan, but this shabby, slightly pathetic figure representing the mediocrity and cynicism within Ivan himself.
When Ivan tries to reveal the truth at Dmitri's trial, his confession is dismissed as the ravings of a madman. He can't bear the weight of his own ideas made real.
So the intellectual brother collapses under the weight of his ideas. But Dmitri, the sensualist, finds a path to redemption through suffering.
Right. He didn't physically kill Fyodor, but he accepts his guilt. Not legal guilt, but moral guilt. For wanting his father dead. For his whole life of excess and hurting people.
He sees the wrongful conviction as a kind of purification. He needs to suffer to become clean.
And that transformation is really cemented by that dream he has in prison, isn't it? The dream of the babe.
Yes, the suffering child. He dreams of this freezing, crying baby in a desolate village and asks why the wee one is crying. It awakens this profound sense of universal compassion in him. He realizes he must suffer not just for himself, but for all the suffering children, for everyone. He accepts the sentence to Siberia as a way to renew his soul.
So the trial itself becomes almost a critique of justice systems that rely purely on external evidence and logic. They convict the wrong man physically, but perhaps the right man morally, in terms of who needed that purification.
And Katerina Ivanovna's testimony plays a huge role. Her pride, her complicated love-hate for Dmitri, leads her to provide the most damning evidence sealing his fate. It shows the limits of rationality when tangled with human emotion.
With the intellect, Ivan, broken, and the legal system failing, the novel seems to suggest the answer lies elsewhere, with Alyosha.
Exactly. Alyosha's path becomes the central one by the end. His own faith gets tested early on, remember, when Zosima dies and his body decomposes unexpectedly, challenging the idea of sainthood. That crisis actually pushes him out of the monastery into the world to practice that act of love Zosima taught.
He shifts away from abstract theology towards direct compassion. His focus becomes the group of schoolboys, especially the dying boy, Ilyusha.
Ilyusha, whose father Dmitri had publicly humiliated. Alyosha works to reconcile the boys, to bring comfort and kindness into this circle of suffering. He doesn't preach, he acts, he connects.
And this leads to that final, very moving scene at Ilyusha's funeral, Alyosha's speech to the boys.
Yes, he doesn't offer complex philosophy, he talks about memory. He urges the boys to hold on to the good memory of Ilyusha and of their shared kindness in that moment.
He suggests that this memory, this feeling of love and connection they experience together, will be a source of salvation for them throughout their lives.
It's a powerful idea that morality isn't just abstract rules, but something felt, experienced, remembered. A good memory can act as a moral anchor against despair or cynicism later in life. It's the counter to Ivan's despair.
So, looking back, you see these contrasting types of love. Fyodor's purely selfish, sensual possessiveness. Katerina's proud, intellectual, almost self-harming love.
And then Alyosha and Zosima's model. Selfless, active, compassionate love. That's held up as the ideal, the difficult but necessary path.
What really stands out, I think, is how Dostoevsky stages this epic battle, not in some cosmic realm, but right inside the human heart. As Dmitri himself realizes, the battlefield is right here.
And ultimately, the novel seems to land on this.
Mm-hmm.
The answer to the overwhelming reality of suffering isn't found in a neat philosophical system, but in the ongoing, conscious, often difficult choice to practice active love and compassion.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.